Gentlemen, meine Damen und Herren, herzlich willkommen bei unserer Open Lecture im Rahmen der Workshop The Rise of Early Christianity in Greece and the Southern Balkans. For tonight, the Open Lecture, we have Professor Jan Bremmer from the University of Groningen. He's going to speak on early Christians in Corinth, religious insiders or outsiders. Professor Bremmer has written extensively on various topics on Christianity, other religions. One of the most renowned historians of ancient religion from the Netherlands. Maybe you have noticed one of his latest books on the mystery religions in antiquity, in which he redefines the description of mystery religions and take, shall I say, a very sound historical approach. He has been awarded many honors, inter alia that he gave the inaugural Getty Villa Professorship at the Getty Research Institute in Los Angeles, and he was visiting lecturer in Edinburgh. He was in Munich, a guest professor, and especially for this topic, his valedictory lecture that he gave when he became emeritus in Groningen, The Rise of Christianity Through the Eyes of Gibbon, Harnack, and Rodney Stark. If you can get your hands on it, please read it. It is very, very good reading, as I am sure his lecture is going to be.
It doesn't work. It's quite amazing that in the most advanced industrial country of the world, perhaps, a simple thing like a loudspeaker doesn't work. It's one of these things. Ladies and gentlemen, many thanks for the invitation. It's always a little bit ambivalent to be the keynote speaker. Jürgen Osterhammel, in his most recent collection of essays, he observed somewhere that if you do it well, it's okay. Everyone says, oh yeah, good lecture. If you don't do it so well, with a glass in the hand, people will say, yeah, had expected better. Or, in my case, he's getting old. So don't raise your expectations too high. But I might say here and there something new. I must add that I'm not a New Testament scholar, so when, like some of the New Testament scholars, they say, yes, but 1 Corinthians 14, verse 5, and another will say, no, John 1, verse 4, I can't play that game. This is only the second lecture I ever wrote about the New Testament, and I didn't start doing that till after I had turned 70. So it's although I'm a pharaoh's son, this is all a kind of foreign country to me. Now, the title of my lecture immediately raises some important questions. Were there actually early Christians in Corinth? Do we know anything about them? And what do we mean when we speak of religious insiders or outsiders? The answer to the first question depends, of course, on our ideas about the early stages of the Jesus movement. Many scholars nowadays would be hesitant to use the term early Christianity, despite the fact that it is quite a reputable recent journal actually edited here in Berlin. The development from a movement within Judaism to a, what we would call today, separate religion was relatively fast. And from about AD 100 onwards, Roman authors no longer mentioned Jews in connection with the early Christians. Just like the pagan philosopher Celsus around AD 180. But it is evident that the separation took place at different speeds, at different places, and with different choices regarding the Jewish legacy, probably also depending on the original Jewish element in the congregation or the presence of Jews in the immediate environment. Taking this development into account, I will sometimes use the expression early Christians also for the time of the Apostle Paul, just for convenience sake. Our second problem is that of insiders and outsiders. The question brings us straight to Corinth itself. The city had been an important center of Greek cultural and commercial life, but was destroyed by the Romans in 146 BC. In 44 BC, Caesar founded a new colony, which soon developed into a flourishing city, and after 27 BC, it became the capital and administrative center of the Roman province of Achaia. Initially, the elite of the city of about 50 to 60,000 inhabitants consisted of a few Roman veterans, but especially of freedmen from leading families of the triumviral and Augustan period. In addition, there were many wealthy merchants, the so-called negotiatores, often coming from the east. It would be fair to say that Corinth was a Roman city, both culturally and materially, in its outlay for at least a century after its foundation. The more so as in 146 BC, the Romans had destroyed the Greek sanctuaries in the city and had left only the extra urban sanctuaries standing. However, when the Apostle Paul visited Corinth around AD 50, old Greek notable families from neighboring cities had just started to enter local politics. In the following decades, the city became more and more Greek, and by the time of Hadrian, Latin had been replaced by Greek, and for the later second century, we may consider Corinth to be a Greek city. Thus, the character of the city changed considerably between Paul's visit and the end of the second century, where we will end our investigation. This coming together of Roman and Greek traditions also manifested itself in the area of religion. The colonists and their successors did imitate Rome, but they soon also venerated traditional Greek divinities and heroes, whose temples could still be seen by the travel writer Pausanias when he visited the city in the middle of the second century. Moreover, in the same century, we can notice the advance of the Egyptian divinities Isis and Serapis, whose appearance on local coins illustrates their local importance. But before them, Judeans had also come to live in Corinth. Philo already knows of a Judean colony in Corinth, and Josephus mentions that Vespasian sent 6,000 Judeans from Magdala to help with the building of the Isthmian Canal. Like many modern coolies in the Americas and the Caribbean, many of them will have surely stayed in Corinth. Chapter 18 of the Acts of the Apostles gives us a good idea of the various elements that must have made up the Jewish community. Mobile Jews from Asia Minor and Rome, a so-called God-fearer, and a head of the synagogue. The latter two boast with Roman names. Similarly, the end of 1 Corinthians mentions a Greek name, Roman names, and a Jewish couple with Roman names. All in all, it seems to have been a sizable community with perhaps the same variety of opinions as in Palestine itself. There might even have been more than one synagogue, as the late 3rd century inscription Synagogue of the Hebrews leaves the possibility open of other buildings. Last but not least, there must have been individual religious entrepreneurs. In his Metamorphoses of about 170, Apuleius precisely locates one of these in Corinth, a Chaldean whose oracular responses are clearly products of a charlatan, who, contrary to the Christian apostles in the apocryphal Acts of the Apostles, or even the Apostle Paul himself, charges big fees, but whose carelessness unmasks him. This is very typical for the Christians in the apocryphal Acts that they don't charge money for their miracles. And the great, I can say, the great Dutch New Testament scholar Willem van Unnik announced a book or a larger article, Evangelium Gratis Dandum, before his death. But I inquired at Pieter van der Horst, but nothing has been found on paper from that idea. But there clearly could be a nice book or big article written about that subject. So even though the scene belongs to fiction, the presence of such diviners and astrologers selling their religious ware is well attested in many places. In other words, Corinth must have been an example of a religious melting pot. Now, the difficulty in such a milieu to speak of insiders and outsiders becomes even more manifest when we realize that the boundaries between the pagan cults were pretty porous. Isis could be represented as a Greek goddess. The mystery language and ritual of Eleusis was widely imitated by other mysteries, and creators of new cults, such as those of Mithras or Jupiter Doligenes, often worked with the same religious material as the more traditional cults, even if in new combinations. Yet we can focus on salient aspects of early Christianity and ask whether these were shared by other cults or religions in antiquity. Obviously, there is a difference over time here. During Paul's life, many an outsider might have looked at him and his followers as Jews, but in the later second century, this will no longer have been the case. Taking this development into account, we are still faced with the problem as to who is actually observing the status of insider or outsider. For our purpose, I will assume the presence in Corinth of intelligent persons, people like Lucian, who have some interest in religion and know something about Christianity. In some of the scholarly literature, it said that Lucian doesn't know very much about Christianity, but I would maintain that he knows just as much about, or he knew just as much about Christianity as most modern intellectuals seem to do. So, in that respect, I don't think there's anything to complain about Lucian. Now, what would such a person as Lucian have struck about the early Christians? Naturally, we cannot discuss in our one lecture everything, and I will therefore make a choice. Subsequently, I will make some observations on the subject of Christian self-understanding, worship, sacrifice and meals, female presence, literacy, and martyrdom. And we will conclude by trying to answer the question of our title. Before we start our actual analysis, we should say a word or two about our sources. The great Adolf von Harnack had already noticed the poverty of Corinthian sources. Das Christentum auf der Balkanhalbinsel ist uns für die ersten Jahrhunderte schlecht bekannt. And indeed, we have only a few sources at our disposal. Of course, we have the letters of Paul to the Corinthians of the early 50s, then the letter of the Church of Rome to that in Corinth, the so-called One Clement, we've heard about that this morning, of about AD 100, and finally the quotations from and observations by Eusebius on the church historian Hegesippus, who traveled to Rome via Corinth around 160, and on Bishop Dionysius of Corinth, who officiated around 170, and about whom we also heard this morning. In addition to these documentary sources, so to speak, we have some fictional accounts in two apocryphal Acts of the Apostles, those of Andrew and those of Paul, dating from the 160s and 170s in the first case, and the late 190s for the Acts of Paul, and written in Asia Minor. These sources can give us some idea as to how contemporaries imagined church life in Corinth, but should of course be used with care. It's typical indeed of our evidence, and this has become very clear today, that there is no epigraphy, Christian epigraphy, for the first 4 centuries, say till somewhere 350, 360 at the earliest, and there is no archaeology. So this is, I think, something which also asks for an explanation. In the case of archaeology, I'm sure it has to do with the house churches. In the case of the epigraphy, it's more curious because in other places, like Phrygia, we have them much earlier. So there must be have been something about Corinth which I simply can't explain. So given this poverty of our sources, still what would our intelligent observer notice? He would first be struck by the fact that the Christians did not have a specific sanctuary, but met in houses, as is explicitly mentioned for that of Aquila and Prisca. This is also how early Christians imagined their own meeting places. In the Acts of Paul and Thecla, Paul preaches in Iconium in the house of Onesiphorus, in Ephesus in the house of Aquila and Priscilla, and in Corinth in the house of Stephanas. Recent excavations have revealed 2nd century fairly small house churches in Israel, but the historical Acts of the Abyssinian martyrs relates that in the winter of 303-304, a group of about 50 Christians was surprised in, I quote, the house of Octavius Felix, where they were celebrating the Sunday meal, presumably on the first floor, like the early Christians in Acts. Obviously, then, the size of the houses has to be correlated to the size of the congregations. As Paul also speaks of, I quote, the whole church in Corinth, there may already have been more than one house church, which would also fit the various existing factions in Corinth, against which Paul argues. Now, how were the early Jesus followers organized? The Toronto New Testament scholar John Kloppenburg, here present, I think with a nice photo, who has invested a lot of time and energy in the study of Greco-Roman voluntary associations, writes, and I quote, early Christ groups were certainly regarded by external observers as varieties of associations, and Judean synagogae, one of the common terms for associations, are easily seen as one form of diasporic association, formed around a common ethnic identity and a common cult. The study of ancient associations is important for understanding the structure, organization, and functions of early Christ groups and Judean synagogues, end quote. Now, as we all know, when does a scholar use the word certainly? Early Christ groups were certainly regarded by external observers. One uses the word certainly when there is no evidence, normally. Certainly, I would say. And indeed, there is, according to me, no evidence that the external observers saw the early Christ groups as voluntary associations. At least not before Tertullian, who I think is the first Christian who did. And the only pagan indication we have is Lucian, who mentions in his Life of Peregrinus that Peregrinus officiated like a head of a thiazos, a thiazarches, a cultic association. This mention is unique, however, and Lucian uses also other words like prophetes for Peregrinus' function without elaborating the association aspect in any way at all. If our observer would have had some thoughts about the nature of the Jesus meetings, he probably would have thought of the mysteries, as Lucian calls Christianity a new teleter. Although the term teleter can mean anything from a ritual in general to a mystery cult, Pausanias, and also more or less contemporaneous with Lucian, uses teleter almost exclusively in case of mysteries, just as Lucian often uses teleter for mysteries in his work. Celsus, another pagan observer, too compared Christianity to the other teletai, and even several Christians, Orthodox and heterodox, had been struck by the similarity of some elements of the Christian ritual, such as baptism and the Eucharist, to those of the mysteries. Moreover, our observer may well have noted the rather striking use of political vocabulary by the early Christians, especially of ecclesia, which we find in Paul's letter to the Corinthians. John has recently also dedicated an extensive discussion to this phenomenon, and he rightly notices that ecclesia can mean assembly and has Jewish roots. But I think that he seems to overlook that the early Jesus followers liked to use also other terms derived from the Essenian democracy, such as politeio, politeia, politeuma, liturgia, liturgos, and choregia. It is this political vocabulary that probably also explains the frequent use of stasis, civil strife in 1 Clement, for the church disputes and internal troubles in Corinth. Can it be that the fairly egalitarian ethos of the early Jesus followers had led Paul to use or introduce this democratic terminology? Given this, what I would say, a rather pretentious vocabulary, our observer may have been surprised that the early Christians nevertheless designated themselves not as citizens, but as paroikoi. At the time of Paul, the term is used for resident non-citizens, but with the notion of dependency and marginality. As such, it can be more negative than terms like visitors and strangers, of course, another favorite term of the early Christians. In the case of Corinth and other Roman colonies, we have to take into account that certainly in the beginning, the Roman citizenship was severely limited. In fact, the stress on being not part of the citizen body may well reflect a feeling of unease among leading Christians. In any case, it is certain that those early followers did not yet call themselves Christians. This name became only popular among Christians fairly late in the second century, and its use greatly intensified with the third century persecutions, when the martyrs confessed their faith with the proclamation, "I am a Christian," Christianus or Christiane, Christianus sum of Christiane emi. In all probability, the designation was invented by Romans in Antioch only later in the first century, and meant to designate a follower of Christ, just as the Romans knew people called Caesariani, followers of Caesar, Pompeiani, followers of Pompeius, or Galbiani, followers of Galba, and so on. For us, it is interesting to see that the Romans saw Christ as the most important figure of the Jesus movement, despite the fact that he had been executed several decades before. The term, therefore, is an interesting indication of the early significance of Christ for his followers. It was his prominence of Christ, in addition to God, that distinguished the earliest Jesus followers from the local, more traditional Jews. But our observer must also have been struck by the exalted language used in connection with Jesus. Let us take, for example, 1 Clement, where the author calls Jesus, I quote, "the high priest of our offerings, the benefactor who helps us in our weaknesses," and hymnically continues with, "through this one we gaze into the heights of the heavens, through this one we see the reflection of his perfect and superior countenance, through this one the eyes of our hearts have been opened, through this one our foolish and darkened understanding springs up into delight, through this one the Master has wished us to taste the knowledge of immortality. He is the radiance of his magnificence, as superior to the angels, as he has inherited a more excellent name." This importance of Christ appears more clearly in the reports of the Christian martyrs. When the Roman governor asked Polycarp to curse Christ, he answered, "For 86 years I have been his slave." The Greek uses the term doulaien. "And he has done me no wrong. How can I blaspheme against my king and savior?" In fact, there are many examples of this close relationship in the acts of the Christian martyrs, sometimes even assuming mystical contours. When the Lyonese martyr Sanctus was cruelly tortured, I quote, "Christ's suffering in him achieved great deeds of glory." And the Passion of Perpetua relates that when asked how she would endure the terrors of the arena while laboring in the pains of childbirth, Felicitas answered, I quote, "Then there will be another one in me who will suffer for me just as I shall be suffering for him." These passages from very different parts of the Roman Empire all suggest a special relationship between God and worshipper that is unparalleled in the pagan world. The early Jesus followers seem to have initiated a trend here. When we look at the meeting places of the Mithras worshippers, we cannot fail to notice that they dined in the close presence of their god, whose statue in relief form stood in the center of the rear wall, whereas normally pagan worshippers would dine in separate rooms of sanctuaries, but not in the presence of their gods. Similarly, at the end of the account of his initiation into the mysteries of Isis in Apuleius' Metamorphoses, Lucius mentions that he had adored the gods from close by, whereas Greek mythology tells how Semele was burned to ashes when she saw Zeus in his full glory. In Apuleius, Lucius' proximity to the gods is stressed, just as he will be displayed on a platform opposite the statue of Isis after his initiation. The proximity fits the trend to a closer connection between worshipper and the gods, as can be witnessed in the first centuries of the Christian era. As the traditional world of the small polis was rapidly changing, people perhaps looked for a closer relationship with the gods in addition to support from their fellow humans. Yet one aspect of this close relationship will have struck non-Jesus followers: the characterization of this relationship as slavery. We find this expression, "slave of Christ," or "to be a slave," in many early Christian writings, such as 1 Clement, and it will have been very familiar to the Corinthians. This self-designation of Jesus' followers as his slaves, and one of the inscriptions of Erci gave us even the personal name Theodoulos, so it shows how important this was. Even though nowadays since the Greek word doulos is translated with servant. I find it very interesting. Clearly, for modern sensibility, we cannot be the slaves. We have to be servant, bad enough, but always better than being a slave. But and this self-designation as slave has its counterpart in the frequent designation of Jesus as the Kyrios, also mentioned by Paul, and Despotes, the master or lord. Now, in the Levant, Kyrios was originally used as a devotional recognition of a local divine leadership status, and it is clear that this was not the usage of the early Christians. For them, Kyrios and Despotes were kinds of supermasters who totally owned them. This divine ownership of free persons must have looked rather strange to non-Christian observers, even though in the East the element of belonging to a god, to be a slave or servant, became more widespread during the late Hellenistic era. Even more surprising to our observer will have been the rejection by the Christians of sacrifice. Our observer may have known that the Jews sacrificed in Jerusalem, but the absolute rejection propagated by Paul will surely have puzzled him. Yet the apostle is perfectly clear. It is not that Paul was a vegetarian. As he stresses, eat whatever is sold in the meat market, in the Greek makelon, the Greek transcription of the Latin macellum, of makelon, whatever you pronounce it. Eat whatever is sold in the meat market without raising any questions on the ground of conscience. But the focal point is the meat of sacrifice. No, I imply that what pagans sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. I do not want you to be partners with demons. These verses have been much discussed, but it is perhaps possible to add a few details. First, we should realize that when transposed to the provinces, Roman religion had not been transferred to Coor, but its rituals had been simplified and made more austere. And this development made that in the provinces, sacrifice, as you can see here, had become even more central than in the metropolis and in the metropolis Rome. Second, it is remarkable how familiar Paul assumes the Macellum to be. Evidently, he knew the market from his first visit to Corinth. His is also the first mention in Greek literature of the Latin Macellum, which we should translate not with meat market, but with fish and meat market. In itself, a derivation from Greek, but probably via southern Italy or Sicily. The word plausibly derives via Punic from Hebrew mikla, or Semitic mikla, I probably should say, enclosure, and only very gradually penetrated into Greek parlance. When at the end of the Roman Republic, meat became increasingly popular in Rome, the Romans also constructed macella in their colonies. Here you have at the top a coin of Nero, and you can see how peculiar, in a way, this macellum building was. It was clearly a round building. You can see it on the coin, and you can see it also on the reconstruction of Leptis Magna in North Africa. So when at the end of the Roman Republic, meat became increasingly popular in Rome, the Romans also constructed macella in their colonies. In the course of time, these macella became so popular in the East that we find the term not only in Greek inscriptions, but even in rabbinic literature. Undoubtedly, though, in Corinth, in Paul's time, the word was still used in its Latin form. Third, although the New Revised Standard Version translates macellum with meat market, it is important to realize that the translation is rather one-sided, as fish was certainly equally important. This can even be seen from Corinthian inscriptions dating to the time of Augustus, which mention both macellum and piscarium. In a well-known debate between Gert Tyson and Justin Maggett, the former has rightly maintained that it were the well-to-do who came to the macellum to buy meat. We must not forget that much of the meat came from sacrifice, where the quality of the sacrificial victim had been closely controlled. So no second-hand animals, no old or ill element animals. The gods only liked the best of the best. Now, it is true, as Maggett maintains, that the Roman poor used to buy types of cheap meat in popinae, stalls at the side. But he has overlooked the fact that early emperors increasingly restricted the sales of food to pulse and vegetables. So at the time of Paul, there will not have been that many popina left. The prohibition may not have been successful everywhere, but it certainly will have limited the number of popinae available to the poorer strata of the Corinthian population. Now, unlike what Gert Tyson suggests, many macella were very close to sanctuaries, as excavations have shown. This proximity is not surprising, as the macella were normally situated in the heart of the city where the most important temples were. Moreover, it was only the proximity to temples that made the availability of fresh meat possible, as most meat derived from sacrifice, although certainly not all, some deriving from the hunt. And that we can certainly presuppose for Corinth. And indeed, Paul's suggestion not to inquire about the meat's origin also implies that some meat did not derive from sacrifice, because if that hadn't been the case, there was no need to inquire. The buying of meat and the invitations by hosts who did likewise just shows that the Jesus movement had managed to convert well-to-do Romans and Greek within 2 decades of the death of Jesus. This astonishing speed still asks for an explanation. Unfortunately, we do not know if the early Jesus followers also took some of their meat to their communal meals. One would think so, as clearly some poor came to the communal meals with very little to eat, whereas others, presumably the more well-to-do, became drunk. Apparently, people had complained about this discrepancy between the well-to-do and the poor to Paul. But what exactly took place at the communal meals? In recent decades, there has been a fierce debate about the origin of the Eucharist, whereby studies of its origins often reveal a clear agenda to show that it is either Jewish, or either Hellenistic Jewish, or Greco-Roman in origin. Now, what would our observer have seen? At first, he may have thought that the meals were just like the symposia of the to him familiar voluntary associations, even if he will have raised an eyebrow about the presence of rich and poor, male and female, and free and slaves amongst the members. In fact, he probably would have been as surprised by the Christians calling one another brother and sister, as the opponent of Christianity, Minucius Felix Octavius, who states that, I quote, "indiscriminately they call each other brother and sister, thus turning even ordinary fornication into incest by the intervention of these hallowed names." But our observer definitely would not have understood the breaking of the bread and the drinking from one cup, as the, plausibly I would say, conclusion of the meal. When looking at the origin of the Eucharist, we should note that the collocation of breaking and bread, in Latin frango and panem, occurs only once in Latin before the advent of Christianity. And the collocation klao and arton, so the Greek for breaking the bread, occurs never in Greek before the Septuagint. But in all of these cases, we only hear about a piece of broken bread, not about a ritual act of breaking it. In addition to the New Testament, breaking of bread during the Eucharist is also mentioned in the second century in the Didache, the Gospel of Judas, the Acts of John, the Acts of Andrew, and the Acts of Paul, after which time the collocation becomes increasingly common. Unlike the contemporary Jews, though, the early Jesus followers did not stress the blessing of the bread, but concentrated on its breaking. Consequently, the breaking of the bread derives from Christianity's appropriation and transformation of its Jewish ancestry at this point. Evidently, the Christian ritual developed from both a Jewish and a Greco-Roman ancestry. Interestingly, Paul uses the term paredoka, from the verb paradidomi, for his delivering of the words of the institution narrative. The verb, I should stress, belongs to the technical terminology of the mysteries, and it seems that Paul on purpose used his solemn term to impress the importance of the Eucharist. In any case, we cannot be sure that the words of Jesus were actually pronounced at the communal meals in Corinth, as a number of texts from 2nd century Christianity show that in many congregations the Eucharist was celebrated without the institution narrative, the institution narrative that in the Gospels where Jesus says, "This is my body and this is my blood," and so on. Regarding Corinth, we do not even know the frequency of the communal meals, or the time of day, or the place of the Eucharist within the communal meal, although it seems plausible to locate it at the end. Yet it seems that the mention of Jesus' body and blood, as well as the terminology of brothers and sisters, was intriguing enough for outsiders to develop slandering tales of cannibalism and incestuous lust. Finally, our observer would certainly have been puzzled by the role of the women during the congregational meetings, as he would have observed them praying and even prophesying. Admittedly, these activities seem to be contradicted by Paul's statement that women should be silent. But Harnack already suspected the later interpolation here, And the fact that these verses, 8 Corinthians 14, 34 and 35, the fact that these verses appear in different locations in different manuscripts supports his view. I would not know any parallel in the pagan world of such an active female presence in a religious meeting or temple. Yet female Christian prophets are already mentioned in Acts in Caesarea, where the evangelist Philip had even 4 daughters that prophesied. That must have been difficult to be a father of 4 of those, I would say. And female prophets long remained active among the Montanists. This unusual behavior may well have lasted beyond Paul's time, as one Clement repeatedly stresses that the Corinthian males should direct their women to be discreet, submissive to their husbands, and exercising, I quote, the gentleness of their tongues. Perhaps it was also these verses of Paul that inspired the author of the Acts of Paul to introduce in his description of Paul's stay in Corinth a prophetess, Myrte, who was seized by the Spirit and pronounced a long prophecy to reassure the congregation that Paul would achieve many conversions in Rome. It is notable, though, that Myrte prophesies within the congregation and clearly not in tongues, just as Paul prescribed. The author of the Acts of Paul is well known for his friendly attitude towards females in the church, which made him foreground the role of Thecla. However, Hegesippus, when visiting Corinth around 160, found the congregation in good order, which seems to suggest that there were no longer female prophets active in Corinth at his time. Now, in a series of contribution, Judith Liu, the Cambridge New Testament chair, has argued that we must see rhetoric behind most of these mentions of a prominent role of women in early Christianity. She bases his contention on the so-called hermeneutics of suspicion, but one must say that she is hardly suspicious of her own method and rarely engages with detailed arguments like those of Harnack, who already noted the importance of women for early Christianity, or differentiates regarding the status of women in early Christianity. There obviously was a different attraction for poor women or for wealthy ones. Whereas the former will have looked for charity, the latter may have aspired to prestige by becoming patronesses of a congregation or to intellectual dialogues with leading males. Chloe, mentioned in 1 Corinthians 10, was perhaps such a patroness of the congregation with her house, which I would locate in Corinth, just as perhaps Prisca and Phoebe in neighboring Cenchreae. We have seen the harbor very close to Corinth. If so, these women would conform to a pattern that we actually can observe on the Peloponnese at the time, where religious benefactresses are well attested, even though on an ideological level, the early Jesus followers underplayed the position of the patrons. In fact, there are many examples known of Christian upper-class women in the first centuries. Bishop Dionysius of Corinth, already familiar to all of us now, even wrote a theological letter to a certain Crucifera, a most faithful sister, as he says. She may not have lived in Corinth, but the letter shows that the Corinthian bishop knew to value these surely wealthy women. Also her name, Chrysophora, gold carrying or so, suggests not a poor lady. The apocryphal Acts of Andrew, as related by Gregory of Tours in his Life of Andrew, even mentions that Jesus visited the house of a woman sinner in Corinth, surely also an upper-class lady. The bishop's letter is a good example of the range of the usage of letters and literacy in early Christianity. The elite of Corinth will have been familiar with the phenomenon of the textualization of Roman religion, as the last century BC had seen important works on the nature of Roman religion, such as Cicero's De Natura Deorum or Varro's Antiquitates Rerum Humanarum et Divinarum, which was such a significant source for Augustine, to whom we owe our knowledge of the book. Although these books were not sacred texts, They made Roman religion legible in ways analogous to Judaism and Christianity. The educated Greeks of Corinth will have been familiar with the many Greek philosophical works on religion, and the Jews of Corinth, insofar as they were not wholly assimilated, may well have known several books from the literature in the period before the destruction of the temple, as exemplified by the Dead Sea Scrolls. Yet, there was no authoritative Greek or Roman holy book, whereas in the emerging Jesus movement, books became central and authoritative. Von Clement already speaks of sacred books, sacred scriptures, and the holy word, Hagios Logos. But these still refer to the Old Testament. In the 180s, however, future martyrs appear before the Roman church with, I quote, books and letters of Paul, a righteous man. In a small town called Skilly in North Africa. Thus it is not strange that the pagan Lucian is struck by the prominence of books in Peregrinus' performance during the latter Christian period. The spread of a book culture among the early Christians was clearly facilitated by the introduction of the Codex. However, the early Christians not only popularized a handier format for books and created thus, in a well-known expression of Guy Strunza, a religion of the paperback, but they also facilitated public reading by introducing a series of features that made that reading easier, such as wider margins, fewer letters per line, and the use of word spaces. The most striking aspect of this Christian communication strategy, though, was its frequent use of letters. This development was unique at the time, and there's nothing comparable in either contemporary Judaism or pagan religions. Indeed, much of our early Christian literature consists of letters, not only those of the New Testament, but also those of Ignatius and Polycarp, and the letter of the congregation of Smyrna to the church of Philomelium about the martyrdom of Polycarp, and that of Jan and Leon to the churches in Asia and Phrygia about the persecution of their members in 177. Clearly, unlike their pagan neighbors, Christians felt themselves part of a much wider community, a community that transcended the borders of the individual polis, that is, also a textual community. This well-known expression was coined in 1983 by the Canadian historian medievalist Brian Stock for communities that are centered on texts and, what is often neglected, their interpreters. But this also seems a useful expression regarding early Christianity. The early congregations listened to the readings of the Old Testament and other important texts, which were explained to them by their presumably most influential and intellectual members, which may have helped to develop the monepiscopate. At the same time, these texts and their interpretations helped to keep the congregation together, to remind them of their traditions, but also to cope with new developments. Also, Corinth was part of this networking, which the epistolary activity promoted. Paul probably realized the innovative character of this strategy, as he wrote to the Corinthians that he did not want to seem to frighten them with his letters. For they say, says Paul, I quote, his letters are weighty and strong, but his bodily presence is weak, and his speech contemptible. And indeed, as Larry Hurtado has shown, the letters of Paul are far bigger than the average pagan letter of his time. We even know that some of these early Christian letters were read to the Corinthian congregation on Sundays, such as a letter of Bishop Dionysius' contemporary Soter, the Bishop of Rome, but also one Clement, the rather dull, I must say, but Larry will probably disagree, the rather dull, much earlier letter from Rome to Corinth. However, the Corinthians did not only receive letters. Eusebius has left us a pretty detailed description of the letters written and presumably still circulating in this time by Bishop Dionysius, whose letters probably had been collected like those of Paul. He wrote to many Greek congregations from Athens to Crete and to Nicomedia about chastity, unity and heresies, such as those of Marcion. These letters show that around 170 he, as a bishop, was now the leading figure in the Corinthian congregation, which clearly had accepted the monoepiscopate, but also the spider in a wide network of Christian churches. Dionysius is so a forerunner of the letter-writing bishops of the 3rd century, such as Cyprian and Dionysius of Alexandria. The authority of his letters is evidenced by the fact that people even falsified and reworked them. In one of his letters, Dionysius wrote to Essens after the execution, and the Greek uses the word martyresai or martyresanta, of their bishop Publius. We don't know the exact date of his execution, but it seems reasonable to date it to the 1970s, to the 170s, that is the time of Marcus Aurelius, from whose rule quite a few martyrs are known, most famously Polycarp. Essens is close to Corinth, but it was typical of the early persecutions that they depended on local circumstances. We need not therefore presuppose Corinthian martyrs at that time. The first known Corinthian martyr by name is Codratus. You see him here. the one on the right is Codratus, and on the left is Dionysius. We need not therefore presuppose Corinthian martyrs at that time. The first known Corinthian martyr by name is in Greek Codratus, Latin of course Quadratus, who was decapitated with others under the Emperor Valerian on March 10, 258. Yet dying for Christ cannot have been unknown in Corinth. Von Clement already mentions the deaths of Peter and Paul, of a great number of elect, and of women that were dressed up as Dirce and Danaids, probably all referring to the time of Nero. One more interesting aspect of Dionysius' letter is that he mentions apostates after Publius' execution. On the whole, we hear very little about apostates or as against converts, but apostasy must have been a recurrent problem for the early Christians. A second interesting aspect is that Dionysius seems to have used the term martyr for Publius, as he uses epi martyrein, testifying, for the non-martyrological usage of the verb. The title martyr was still relatively young and seems to be attested first in the Apocalypse of Peter. The persecutions during Marcus Aurelius may well have helped to popularize the terminology. Conclusion. With the martyrdom, we have come to the end of our observation. What now would our observer have said? Obviously, we have to differentiate here depending on the period, as what counted as alien clearly changed over time. In the early 50s, many observers would perhaps have been surprised by the fact that they could see a religious group that did not share an ethnic or civic identity. Yet at first they may also have thought of the early Jesus followers as a peculiar form of the Judeans, with their monotheistic belief and funny taboos. Outsiders, sure, but perhaps not that different from other diasporic communities, such as Egyptians, Phoenicians, or Syrians. In the course of time, though, when they had become sufficiently differentiated from the Judeans, the Christians must have looked much more like outsiders. Their exaltation of Christ and focus on books may have looked only a bit peculiar, although not wholly outside the norm. But a combination of their fierce opposition to sacrifice, of their political vocabulary with a minimizing of social statuses, of the special position of their women, of their secretive meal practices, and last but not least, of their stubborn willingness to die for their gods, put the early Christians beyond what was acceptable for the civic and imperial elites. Obviously, local attitudes changed over time and place. What was acceptable in Corinth in, say, 170, may not have been acceptable in essence in the same time. The question of insiders or outsiders might be just as difficult to answer as, say, the question as to what Germans think of the Muslims. This may well depend on whom you ask, a cosmopolitan Berliner or someone from deepest Bavaria. Yet when all is said and done, it is clear that the Jesus movement developed on a collision course with traditional pagan religion. At AD 200, though, the result of that collision was still far from decided. Thank you.
Professor Grimmer, thank you for a very wide-ranging lecture with very detailed aspects, and I'm sure there is people who have questions. If you are willing to answer a few questions, it would.
But we must speak loudly, because as I get older, the hearing only gets a lot worse.
We have a mic, sir.
Oh.
Ich würde gerne, wenn wir zurück zum ersten oder zu den ersten Fotos, dass die Synagoge von Korinth, die Datierung war Ende des dritten Jahrhunderts, war das nicht so?
On commission, I mean, I happily give it for another day, but
okay,
that's what I read on the third century.
Es gibt viele, viele Datierungen dafür, von ersten Jahrhundert bis zum fünften Jahrhundert. Es ist inzwischen diese. Ende der dritten Jahrhundert. Das war nicht im spätantike Korinth-Korpus gekommen, weil das früher als etwa 300 meiner Meinung nach ist.
Ungefähr 300?
Ja. Ja. Wir beginnen etwa mit 300, aber das ist viel, viel. Meines Erachtens ist das 20. Jahrhundert. Ja. Aber das ist zu kurz. Nicht gut. Schlechte Arbeit. Dann ist das schwieriger zu datieren, 20. Jahrhundert. Aber es gibt viele verschiedene Datierungen dafür.
Okay. No, I'm glad I was so clear.
Yes.
It was a long day. I'll be shy.
Thank you, Shai.
I enjoyed your lecture very much. Thank you. I'm curious to know if, instead of talking about Christians, we would have spoken about Jews, would you have had exactly the same tension between insiders, outsiders, belonging, not belonging, separate but distinct, or would the dynamic have played out differently?
I understand you well. If I would have to say about the Jews.
Yes, took this lecture of Jews and the Bible, the Christians, and then the same question, the insiders or outsiders.
I think it would have been slightly different, because the Jews certainly, say, before 70, they would conform to a distinct ethnic and religious community. So that was accepted in the ancient world. I think after 70, it becomes different. And this has also to do, I think, with, what should we call them? As you know, there's a famous article by Steve Mason who said we should just call them Judeans and no longer about Jews, which not all modern Jews appreciate very much the argument. I'm inclined to say that certainly before 70, maybe before 100, I would talk about Judeans. But say, if we talk about, say, the third century, somewhere in Asia Minor, where they have been for many generations, I would certainly call them Jews. But there is a kind of fluid, I think, time where it's hard to say what one should say. But in general, it's well known that the already people like Horace and Ovid comment, for example, on the Sabbaths. Juvenal comments on the fact that beggars go to the synagogue. So clearly, one could give, I think, the same, say, a certain type of lecture, but in later say the second century, I think it would already be different from maybe the first century or the first century BC, but when we have, say, like in Egypt, also very morbid tales about the Jews.
Thank you again for your paper. I enjoyed it a lot. And I guess, and to a certain extent, following on from Shia's question, I'm thinking about the, sort of the framing of your paper as being about insiders versus outsiders. And I'm curious what that frame is doing for you, because clearly Christians are in cities. They are in places. They're not outside anywhere. There's no outside to the Roman Empire. And to a certain extent, so much of what you've been doing is you've been having these sort of mobile viewers, right? A viewer in the first century, a viewer in the second century, viewers on Jews and Judeans at different times. And I guess the question would be, who is looking and who is doing the determining of who's an outsider? And I'm not even sure do we want to play that game with our sources, and why do we even want to play that game with our sources? These are people or groups that are in the ancient world. They're not outside of it. So I guess what's at stake for you in trying to figure out if Christians are insiders or outsiders? What does that mean for you to make that judgment, I guess?
I think you should not neglect the adjective religious insiders or outsiders. I mean, I will be the last to deny that they live in Corinth, but that doesn't mean that they are a religious insider or outsider, that immediately clear. And it seems to me, certainly the Jews were religious outsiders. We have, say, from Manetho to Tacitus, that there are numerous slandering stories about Jews, which clearly, I think, label them as outsiders. They are not like us. That is what I mean. And so, in a religious aspect, there's an enormous, I think, leeway, but there comes a moment that you fall outside the fold. And in the case of the Christians, if they were just like us, they wouldn't have been persecuted. Very simple, I think. So there clearly is something in that which the Romans, the Roman administration did not find acceptable.
At certain times and in certain places, right? Not all the time and not at every place. Right?
Yeah.
You can say the Jews are outsiders, but then they have a very nice synagogue in Sardis.
Yeah.
Right off the forum, you know?
No.
So I guess the question is sort of like, why is it that the Romans as a cohesive entity will say that Christians are outsiders at various points? And I guess I'm not sure what do we gain from that other than saying that at certain points Christians or other minority groups became scapegoats or became victims of certain kinds of institutional persecution?
I didn't reduce my talk to just whether they were scapegoats or not. I don't even would say that they are always scapegoats. I think that in principle, they were always possible subjects of persecutions, but it depended on the local place, time, whatever, whether that was actually realized. But I don't think there was a period after Nero, that Christians could be, till 260, that Christians could be absolutely certain that they would not be persecuted. It seems to me that we don't have the evidence for that.
Thank you for your fascinating paper with many provocative insights. There is a tendency among New Testament scholars of early Christianity to assume that joining a group of Christ believers was an exclusive commitment that ruled out participating in other forms of religion in the city. But the analogy that you draw between these early groups of Christ followers and the teletai of the Greco-Roman world. As far as I know, mystery religions did not demand an exclusive commitment from those who participated. You could have yourself initiated into different groups. So I'm just wanting to know how you view this tendency of scholars of early Christianity to assume that a commitment to a Christian group was an exclusive commitment that ruled out participation in civic cults or in other mystery associations.
To me, it seems there's a certain postmodern tendency to assume that you had flexible identities, say Eric Rubin, a well-known example of that. I personally don't believe that. I don't see any evidence for that. But I think what we should think of is the fact that the Christian way of life is developing. I mean, what was acceptable yesterday might not have been acceptable anymore tomorrow. And even within that, when I was young, I was forbidden to go to the movies. No dancing, no theater. But my aunt, who was only one shade and church away, had no problems with that and took me to around the world in 80 days, which was a fascinating experience for me. And there must have been the same, I think, in many Christian towns, the Christians who said, no, I think I can go to the theater, and others would say not. But that doesn't mean that they have different identities or so. I mean, anyway, I think that the term identity is a very slippery term, which, if you're interested in, there is in the Archief für Kulturgeschichte of 2005, there's an excellent article which gives you the Forschungsgeschichte of the term identity. And there you see how since it's quite developed from the 40s till now. And I don't think it's personally, I don't think it's that useful, and you will not find it very often in what I write.
If I may, I have a very short question. You use the reference to Paradidonai in 1 Corinthians 11 to relate the Christian Eucharist to the meals of the mystery religions. Is in that reference of you that I do not know the verb also used reflectively? Is it also used that the night he was, the sentence in 1 Corinthians is the night he was handed over, or he was, he was handed over. How is it used there in the reference in the mystery religions?
In the mystery religions, it's the mystery cults, yeah. I say. And Paradidomi is used, say, for the instruction of the future initiates.
Okay, but it's not a person handed over to a opposing force?
No, not in the context of the mysteries, no. Oh.
Any other questions? Robin, thank you very much again for your very